Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Coming up on episode 227 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the 2022 Lexus RX 450H, the 22 Jeep Compass, Tesla stops playing games in motion, the F-150 Lightning battery size, solar roofs on cars, selling EV parts, and speeding up EV charging. All that and more coming up next. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 227 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abdul Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakelin from Auto Bytel.
And I think Roberto on this morning after Christmas must be sleeping off a tamale hangover. We haven't seen him yet today. Still early on the West Coast. I saw pictures that he posted of making fresh tamales the other day, and it got me really hungry.
I've never had fresh tamales. That would be good. Never in my life. Are they good?
I love fresh tamales.
Oh, that sounds really good.
But enough of that. Enough of the food talk for now.
Food.
What have you been driving this week?
I am in the 2022 Jeep Compass Trailhawk. The Compass is all new for 2022, so they made some changes. They updated how it looks on the outside. They did some interior upgrades. What didn't change was the engine. It's still a 2.4 liter four-cylinder.
It's not really all new.
No. It's kind of new. It's partly new. It's moderately new. The moderately new 2022 Jeep Compass Trailhawk. So engine, 177 horsepower, 172 pound-feet of torque. There's a 6-speed or a 9-speed automatic, depending on the trim you get. The Trailhawk has the 9-speed. Transmission is fine. It's not a lot of power. You smash the gas in this. It's a decent-sized little crossover SUV situation. It'll get up to speed, but it's not as aggressive as I would like it to be. I feel like it could use a little more oomph. So if you're looking for something that has that little, like, sort of a stronger acceleration, it's not that this doesn't go, but it doesn't go with great enthusiasm. How's that? Yeah. So there is no option. That is the engine that you get, regardless of which trim that you get. One of the other new things they did for this year, there is a new, and I obviously didn't drive this trim, there's a new Latitude Luxe trim that's sort of like a fancier trim level. It sits between the Latitude and the Trailhawk, if you look at their trim ladder. So you have one more fancy trim. The nice thing, though, is whichever one you get, they did make the interior nicer. They upgraded a little bit. They changed the dash layout. things look and feel a little nicer. The Compass used to feel a little down market, especially when you looked at some of the other Jeep offerings, which just have these beautiful interiors, whether you're looking, you know, the fancy schmancy Grand Wagoneer, or you're just looking at a Cherokee, or even looking at like the Wrangler and like some of the trim upgrades you can get on that. The Compass didn't really have that, but now it's looking pretty good. I feel like they did a nice job upgrading that. Also on the list of things that you can have in the infotainment-wise, there's an 8.4-inch screen that's standard, or a 10.9, depending on what I looked at, Sam, I got two different numbers. It's either 10.1 or 10.25. I don't know, so we're going to go with 10-ish. A 10-inch-ish screen that's actually really nice to use. It's, and it has the latest version of Uconnect. I've always been a fan of Uconnect. I think it's one of the easier systems to learn. And I think it's one of the easier systems to navigate. And even if you're the passenger who's never set foot in a Stellantis product in your life, you can sit down and use it and not feel like you're just, I don't know what to do. I can't find anything. It's a pretty intuitive system. So I like it. You get wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto on this one. You've got dual phone connectivity on my trim. And again, not all of this is standard because it's a, I had the 10-ish inch screen with some of the upgrades. The smaller system doesn't have some of the standards, the smaller screen size. But I like the infotainment, and I've always liked it in this, you know, and it has a touch screen, Sam, which you hate and I love. So there's no wonkity little controller or touchpad on the center console. Also, because this is the Trailhawk, it gets a little extra stuff. Now, you don't think of the Compass as being the most off-road capable Jeep out there, but if you get the Trailhawk, you could do some off-roading in this. The regular 4x4 system, doesn't have a low range. The Trailhawk, you get a low range. Also, you have select terrain that normally is auto, snow, and then a sand and mud mode. In the Trailhawk, you also get a rock mode and hill descent control. So that gives you a little bit, it does give you a little extra capability, and you get some extra stuff in there too. The ride height's a little bit higher. You get some skid plates, you get red tow hooks, which is like a Trailhawk thing. They always have red tow hooks on the front. So they do some, you know, there are some upgrades. It isn't like every Trailhawk, it's not just for looks. They actually have things that will make it more off-road worthy. If it wasn't just a giant hellscape of snow and ice, like literal ice that's an inch thick everywhere right now, I might be tempted to take it off-road. But I just see myself just skidding down an incline and never getting my car back ever
again. When you got ice, there's only so much that, you know, a fancy four-wheel drive system can do.
That's
you
the need thing.
You need, like, you know, serious tires to handle.
Exactly. There's no grip on the ice. It doesn't matter how capable you are, which is a thing. Like, you know, driving in New England, you get snow, all these SUVs were all like, yeah, we got four-wheel drive, we're out there, we go and do our thing. But then as soon as you get ice, it's like, whoa, 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 this is not the same ballgame. And we got ice from Christmas Eve until even this morning. It's just now beginning to melt off the trees, but it was that kind of ice where you can't get into your car. You have to like bash the ice to get in. So we've just had really icy roads. It did handle great yesterday driving when we went to Christmas. It was fine on that sort of icy, slowy mix. I felt a couple times when the wheels wanted to slip, but then they find their footing pretty fast. So it did give you a little bit of extra confidence. I liked how it drove in really terrible weather, like the kind of thing where you have, like, we had, you know, 10 car pileups because people were just skating across the ice and couldn't stop. So it was capable in terms of just a bad weather vehicle, not necessarily an off-road thing. Very capable bad weather vehicle. So overall, I like it. I I'm not super keen on the powertrain because it doesn't have enough oomph to it. It needs a little bit more. In terms of cost, we're at $32,500. With the extras that I had on there, there's like a convenience group, a sudden sound group, a tailor toe group. Mine topped out at $38,395. Sam, any guesses on destination? It'll make you cringe.
I'm going to say on the Compass, $1,700.
Oh, you were a little high. It was 1,000. Really? Yeah, 1,595. Only a little high.
Oh, okay.
So bargain.
Off by $100.
Yeah, by $100. So, Price is Right, though, rules you would have lost because you went over.
That's true. That's true.
Right? You should have come. So,
closest without going over.
Closest without going over. So, so overall, I mean, I like the Compass. It's not my favorite of the Jeeps. There's a lot of competitors out there. I think what you do get with a Compass that you don't necessarily get in this segment and necessarily at this price is you do have the genuine off-road capability if you want the Trailhawk. There's other off-road capable vehicles that are going to come in at this range. But as far as the size and everything, if you want that sort of smaller, kind of not really, not as big as a Cherokee, you want something a little bit more compact, this fits the bill. Overall, I like the Compass. I think the upgrades they did were good. I think the, you know, it looks a little bit more in line with the rest of the Jeep brand on the outside, what they did in the front. Little upgraded interior, the upgraded infotainment is nice. And yeah, if you want to go off-road, if you want to do, you really can do it in this little guy.
You know, the closest direct competitor in the market, I think, to the Compass Trailhawk is Ford's Bronco Sport.
Yeah.
It's very similar in size, similar overall specs. Although the Bronco Sport, you have the option of the 1.5 liter turbo is the standard, which is similar power output. It's about 180 horsepower to the 2.4 and the Jeep. But you also have that 250 horsepower 2 liter EcoBoost that they offer.
Yeah.
You've driven the Bronco Sport. How would you compare this against the Compass?
I feel like in terms of just to make sure everybody really gets it, the Bronco and the Bronco Sport are very different vehicles. So, like, the Bronco Sport right. isn't just like, oh, we made a smaller Bronco. It is not as capable as the Bronco, so I don't want anyone to think I'm...
The Bronco Sport is based on the same platform as the Escape.
Right, so it's
the big Bronco is a body on frame, shared with
right.
the Ranger.
Right, so because sometimes people get confused by this, and they're like, "No, these are entirely different animals." So it makes
it's like a Mustang and a Mach-E,
Yes, like very yes.
They both
like
have a pony.
Yes,
very different vehicles.
Exactly. So it's kind of like that with us. So, but it does make sense to compare the Bronco Sport to this. I think in terms of how they drive with that more horsepower engine, you get more oomph and it's more fun to drive the Bronco Sport with that. In terms of off-road capability, I feel like they're pretty well matched until you put the Trailhawk in there. Once you put the Trailhawk in there, I feel like the Jeep feels like, to me, it's a little bit more capable. It feels like it has a little more robust. I don't know what the ground clearance it looks to me, and I haven't looked up what it is for the Bronco Sport. It's looking at it, it feels like the Compass, because I know the Trailhawk actually gets more than the rest of the lineup, too. And I don't know off the...
Ground clearance on the Bronco Sport is 7.8 inches on the base and the big bend, 7.9 on the outer banks. And
so it's a decent amount of ground clearance. That would be my wonder.
I think the Jeep is a little more. I think it's about 8.5.
It feels like just looking at it, I'm trying to pull up specs as we're sitting here right now. It feels like you might have a little bit more ground clearance in the Compass. So if you were, if you're really crawling around off-road and you want to make sure that you have enough room to get over stuff, that's my guess. I'm scrolling down this giant sheet. I'm going to find it when we're not even talking about this anymore.
Oh, it's actually about the same. So the Trailhawk is 8.6 inches. The regular four-wheel drive, the non-Trailhawk four-wheel drives are 8.1. So they're a little bit more.
So and it's got a little bit extra.
Almost an inch more with the Trailhawk.
Which doesn't seem like a lot until you've got something that's just barely sticking up and is, going to hook you up. So I feel like I would go between the two. If I took Trailhawk out, I don't know. I'd almost go with the Bronco Sport for that more powerful engine. But if you want the off-road capability, even with the engine not being as nice in the Compass and as responsive, I think I would still go with it with the Trailhawk if off-roading was my thing.
Yeah,
for a comparison.
I've driven the Compass a couple of times on the off-road course at the Chelsea Proving Grounds, the Stellantis' Proving Grounds west of here. And, it's got some pretty serious off-road chops, driving it through, 20 inches of water, mucky water, going over logs and boulders and things like that. It's got some pretty serious off-road capability, despite being, a crossover, it's based on a car platform.
Right.
It does well for itself. And I think, generally anytime you get anything from Jeep that has a Trailhawk badge on it and those red tow hooks, you can be fairly confident in its abilities to go, you know, most places.
Right.
Obviously, it's not going to be quite as capable as a Wrangler, mm-hmm. but you know, it's still got plenty. I think the one advantage that the Bronco Sport has is it is taller. It's got a taller roof than the Compass does.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things that Ford has touted with the Bronco Sport is the ability, when you fold the back seats down, you can get a bike rack that goes inside, and you can put two mountain bikes, take the front wheels off. You can put two mountain bikes inside the Bronco Sport because it's tall.
Right.
The roof is tall enough. You can't do that in the Jeep.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, I think, you know, the Jeep, you know, has a much nicer, a much more upscale feeling interior than
Definitely.
The Ford does. The Ford,
yeah.
You know, it's predominantly hard plastics. It doesn't feel as premium. You know, it's certainly solid, but it doesn't feel premium. You know, and you can certainly get the Bronco Sport into the same mid to upper $30,000 price range,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the Jeep, to me, feels like it's worth more. You know, just in terms of the materials and the fit and finish. Than the Bronco Sport does.
I agree. It's and that's sort of like a to me is a Jeep thing. Like they, you know, Jeeps aren't cheap vehicles. You know, they're not inexpensive, but the interiors, even when you go to their base models, the base trims in any model, they do a really good job of making them where they use less expensive materials or spots where either you don't feel it or touch it so often, or you're not staring at it so often. So what you're seeing always looks nice, and what you're touching feels nice. So it's not like everything in there is covered in quilted leather or anything like that, but it just has an overall more upscale feel. And it has a lot to do with, like, you know, choosing where to use nice materials and where to say, well, let's make that plastic, that little bit plastic. I feel like they do a better job of that than Ford. Ford's interiors, as a rule, again, tend to feel a little bit more a little cheaper, even when it's not like, oh, the quality is terrible. Like, if you compare it, it's probably very similar in some regards. It's just choosing where to use those less appealing visually and tactily materials. Jeep does a really good job about deciding where to put those so that you feel like you're in a nicer vehicle.
And yeah, you know, it's funny. That's a decidedly post-bankruptcy thing for Stellantis / Fiat Chrysler. You know, prior to 2009, yeah, their interiors were terrible.
They were awful.
The first generation Compass. I don't know. Did you ever drive one of those?
I don't know if I ever drove it. Was it terrible?
Was
it awful?
It was a pretty horrendous vehicle. Yeah, I mean, hard plastics. You could see flashing marks. You know where it came. Where the plastics came out of the mold. It was not good.
Oh man.
And yeah, the powertrain was even way worse than what it is now. After Fiat took over after the bankruptcy reorganization, you know, in the span of about 18 to 24 months, you know, by 2011, basically the entire, you know, Chrysler, Jeep, Ram, Dodge lineup had their interiors completely revamped. And, you know, while they weren't perfect, they were a huge step up, and they've continued to get better ever since. And I think, you know, the current Compass is a good example of that.
A good example. Yeah. And like the little tweaks they did this year, it wasn't looking as good comparatively as the rest of the Jeep lineup, and the tweaks that they made, it's like, okay, let's up this a little bit. It's slipping behind. And they did. They brought it up. So now it feels and looks better than it did. So yeah, I mean, and I generally, you know, I like it. I think you have to weigh it. The value proposition is the one where you can get kind of sketchy. Like if you're looking for, again, for the off-road thing and you want the Trailhawk, sure, go for it. But if you're just looking for a crossover, well, you know, there might be better options out there that are more affordable that do the same thing. But if you, you know, Jeep.
But it's a Jeep.
It's a Jeep. It's a little Jeepy Jeep. I mean, how can you not love the little Jeepy Jeep? So, yeah.
All right. So I had a very different kind of crossover this week. I had the 2022 Lexus RX 450H F Sport Black Line. I think that's all of the suffixes it had on it. So, you know, the RX, you know, the current generation RX has been around for a while. It's probably nearing the end of its current model cycle. I would guess probably in another year or so, we'll see a new redesigned RX. You know, this one was in a new color, celestial blue, which is quite an attractive shade of blue. I've never been a huge fan of the RX. It's nice, but
it's, you know, nice. It's Lexus. Yeah. It's nice.
Well, you know, I mean, it's got it definitely has the things that you expect of a Lexus. It's quiet. It's smooth. You know, the hybrid, you know, is, well, actually this is the one area that's kind of disappointed me the most about this one this week, driving this one. This one has a 3.5 liter V6, that they've had in the RX hybrid for quite a while now. And, paired with, a Toyota Lexus hybrid drive unit at the front, and then an electric motor on the rear axle. And it's EPA rated at 30 miles per gallon combined, 31 city, 28 highway. And I've only been averaging about 23. And it's not like I've been
really
driving this. Yeah, I have not been driving this thing particularly aggressively, just driving it normally the way I always do. And I usually get pretty close to the EPA label numbers. And this one is just not doing it. It's been a little on the colder side, but it hasn't been frigid. You know, and cold temperatures, you know, tend to be more of a problem for hybrids because, you know, the batteries don't have as much power when they're cold. But still, you know, I mean, there's lots of times when this thing's, I can see, you know, on the cluster, it's, you know, driving in EV mode, and yet it's still only averaging about 23 miles per gallon, which is not especially impressive, you know, in a vehicle in this class, this segment, you know, this kind of midsize crossover segment. 22-23 miles per gallon is fairly standard, even for standard gas versions. This does have plenty of performance. That's not an issue. But in the past when I've driven the RX hybrid, and I've driven it a couple times before in the current generation, it's definitely done better. It's done closer to, 27, 28. So I'm a little surprised. I'm not quite sure what's going on here. This one does have the F Sport package on it, which probably hurts it a little bit. But I think the last one I drove was also an F Sport. So this has got 20-inch wheels, black painted alloy wheels, which are part of the Black Line package, I think. The infotainment system in here, you mentioned earlier, a touchpad. This still has the dreaded Lexus touchpad, which is just a really terrible interface. It's not good.
It's awful. It just isn't good. No matter how much they change that, you're like, hey, it's really better now. You're like, nope, it's just bad in different ways, but keep trying.
As I said, you know, this particular generation probably only got about a year and a half left on it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, when the new one comes out, it will adopt the same new infotainment system that's in the new NX that you've driven.
Which is much better.
Way, way better. Yeah.
Far way superior. Better. Yeah.
This is still the two-row version. They do offer a slightly longer-bodied three-row version of it, but frankly, don't. Just don't. If you're thinking about an RX, just don't. If you need a third row, get something else.
Yeah.
Don't get the RXL, because that third row is just, it's too small to be useful for really anything. Just get the, you know, if you're interested in a two row, you know, this is a good choice. Otherwise, you know, there are much better choices for a three row crossover.
Yeah.
So this is in the same size, class, and weight and everything as something like a Lincoln Nautilus, the Infiniti QX50, things like that. You know, I mean, if you want a three-row, the QX60 is a much better choice than this one. But this is not the three-row anyway, so we don't need to worry about that. It's got all the usual accoutrements in there. You know, Toyota and Lexus vehicles now have all pretty much have a full suite of driver assist features as standard equipment. So that stuff is all there. This one, the F Sport, is priced out MSRP of $51,200, all in, including the only $1,025 delivery charge.
Ooh, a bargain.
A bargain. Came to $59,380. So, you know, just shy of 60 grand, which is, yeah, it's a lot. It's, you know, it's not an inexpensive vehicle. You know, the RX Hybrid starts at $48,000 for the base trim level. You know, I think if you like the design, great. It's not a bad design. You know, I think it's better than the previous generation was. You know, I don't mind the way it looks, but I think it is getting a little long in the tooth compared to, you know, some of the competition. And, you know, we'll be seeing a new one sooner rather than later. And in fact, we should be seeing the RZ, which is the Lexus branded EV crossover off the same platform as the new Subaru Solterra and the Toyota BZ4X, terrible name. Lexus has already released teaser images of that one, and we will probably see that one sometime before the end of 2022. So you might want to consider holding off and maybe taking a look at the RZ instead of the RX as an alternative.
Yeah.
It's a Lexus, so it's going to be reliable. It's going to be high quality stuff. There's not going to be any rattles and, you know, things falling off the thing. You know, it's going to run pretty much forever. And I think in most cases, you know, my current example aside, you know, they generally have pretty good fuel economy. I'm not sure what's going on with
that's
this
so weird
example.
That you're having issues with fuel, because normally you, especially Sam, you're pretty spot on to whatever it says it's supposed to get, regardless of the kind of car that you're driving.
Right. And that's why I was a little surprised that, you know, to barely be getting over 23 with this one.
That's weird.
But otherwise, you know, it's a good, you know, premium crossover if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. I think it'll, you know, a large part of the problem that you're seeing with this is just that it's due to be given some serious attention. And it's falling behind where other Lexus vehicles are right now. And like you said, with that infotainment that's just god awful, it'll be better with the next one. They just haven't gotten there yet. So you're looking
at least it does have Android Auto and Apple CarPlay support, but it's wired. So you do have to plug your phone in.
So, yeah. I mean, at least it's there. But I think, this feels like one of those vehicles, like, okay, it was probably great a little bit ago. Now it's falling behind a little. If you give it time until it is whatever its next incarnation will be, it will probably be really good again. But it's a little bit lackluster in some respects right now.
Yeah, I mean it's a competitive marketplace out there. And there's a lot of really good options out there today. You know, including from Jeep. You know, as an example. I mean, we talked about they're getting much more premium than they used to be. Something like the Grand Cherokee, especially with the new, the 4xe that's coming up early in the new year, the plug-in hybrid, that might be something that, a Lexus buyer might want to take a serious look at.
Right. Yeah. Because it does, it's surprisingly premium how Jeep has gone. So, yeah. So there's competition for the RX coming from all quarters right now. You know, it's not a segment where there aren't a lot of options. There are a lot of options. So to make any vehicle, Lexus or anybody's, competitive, you have to step up your game and you have to keep it current. I just think I don't think that Lexus is like neglecting this or anything. I think, you have a cycle and it's just not there yet. It's like, it's hitting that spot where it desperately needs it, but we're not quite there yet.
Yeah.
You know,
there's always a product cadence for everything, and there's a time when it's fresh out of the factory and there's a time when it's been on sale for 4 or 5 years. And, the RX is, at the far end of that scale.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And especially with a lot of new EVs in a similar kind of market segment coming out, there are a lot of interesting options.
That's really like the big challenge. There are so many EVs coming out that sit right in the same segment. To be a hybrid and to not be like a really stellar one for whatever the reason, it's like, you've got other hybrids, you've got other non-hybrids, and you have other EVs that all compete in that same little segment. It's like, this segment is super competitive, you know?
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
All right, let's talk about some of the stuff that's been happening this week.
Okay.
Stay with infotainment for a minute. We talked last time, I think, about Tesla allowing passengers to play games on the infotainment
screen. You didn't
screen
see Sam's air quotes, passengers.
While the vehicle is in motion. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration got a little bit concerned about that and sent some letters to Tesla and said, hey, what's going on here? Threatened to take some regulatory action. And So Tesla promised to push out an over-the-air update that disables the playing of games while the vehicle's in motion. I think the fact that they ever allowed this in the first place to me is just a sign of a really bad culture within Tesla, from an engineering and safety standpoint. This just never have happened.
There's the whole thing with infotainment in general, Tesla's included, is that it lets you do stuff that, like, you think about all the things that you can do that are allowable on an infotainment system while you're driving, that if you've ever tried to do sometimes yourself, or you've watched the person driving as you're a passenger and they do something that's reasonable, they're trying to change directions or they're trying to hit play or whatever, and you think, okay, we're gonna go off the road now, look where you're going. And you think of those little tiny things, how often they can distract you and screw you up. Like, to give someone the opportunity to push it even further and to play a game. Like, think what it does when you're doing the stuff you are okay to use on infotainment, and how it can screw you up. The potential there for it to be a screw up when you're not really the passenger and you're playing a game. Yeah, it seems like it's a step too far. You want to say we're all really reasonable, responsible grown-ups, right? And nobody's ever going to play a game on their Tesla infotainment screen. Who would do that if they're driving? And you're like, 90% of people. Like,
yeah.
When you look at how people use their infotainment systems and their phones, 90% of people are going to use it the wrong way. Because, like, how do you ever even go a day where you don't see someone with their phone up in front of them doing something as they're driving? Like, you can't even go to the grocery store and not run into that. So, it's a given. People are going to break the rules. So I think it's a good idea for them to lock that out, because I just think it the potential for people to abuse that is just huge.
I mean, I actually really like that they've done things like incorporate video games and media streaming services into the infotainment system.
Yes.
Because an EV, there are going to be times when you're sitting there waiting for it to charge, and you can sit there for half an hour, 40 minutes,
right,
whatever. Having something to occupy your time while you're sitting there, I mean, you're not always going to go do your shopping or whatever while you're waiting, especially if you're on a road trip.
Right.
And so having something that you can do while you're sitting there is great. I think that was a brilliant idea to put Netflix and Spotify and the games in there. But just don't do it while the car's in motion. It's just
exactly
a bad, bad idea.
I agree. I mean, I think it's fine to have that stuff there, but I just don't – there's some things you don't need to have that while the car is in motion. You just don't. It just opens up too big of a can of worms, and the potential for drivers to get themselves in trouble. And like I said, we have enough ways that drivers get themselves in trouble with infotainment as it stands. So, like, to give them the ability to, like, stream Netflix or play games and do some of these things while a car is moving, it's like, guys, no.
Yeah.
don't do that.
All right. Staying with EVs, actually, I think pretty much all the stories we have are somewhat EV related. Yeah,
they are.
This week we got confirmation on the battery sizes for the F-150 Lightning, which is launching in the spring. Production should be kicking off probably sometime. I think they've been doing pre-production vehicles for a while now at the plant in Dearborn. They've been building prototypes there on the assembly and using this assembly equipment. And full production, I think, is scheduled to kick off sometime in February. When I saw the Lightning, when I got a backgrounder last May before it was revealed, you know, they wouldn't tell us at the time how big the batteries were. They only talked about the expected range of about 230 miles for the standard range, 300 miles for the extended range. So working back from that, I did some estimating that the standard range battery is probably going to be about 115 kilowatt hours, and the extended range is probably going to be about 150 to 160. Turns out they're actually smaller than that. They're only 100 kilowatt hours for the base model and 131 for the extended range, which means that this thing, you know, if they actually hit those range targets that they're talking about, is actually quite a bit more efficient, energy efficient than the Mach-E. And definitely more efficient than I was expecting it to be.
Which is kind of a nice thing and a good thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you want to see that the more that we can get out of a battery without having to be absolutely ridiculously gigantic, the better. So I guess that's a good thing that they're, whatever strides they're making in their engineering and their battery technology, that they're able to get more out of it. They didn't say anything, and I'm scanning down this story. Nothing changed range-wise, right?
They haven't said range, right? Yeah.
Okay, so theoretically then, that would be the next thing. And next week, no. Our story is the range has changed. Now, if they can keep those ranges with those batteries, that's pretty impressive. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the range estimates that they've had for the Mach-E, you know, have been, you know, the real world range has been pretty close to, you know, the estimated range. So I would expect that the Lightning is probably going to be pretty similar, you know, that it should, you know, at least hit those range numbers and, you know, in nominal use cases, which is good, you know, because you said, you know, the batteries are the single most expensive component in an EV, and, you know, if you can get the range that you're looking for with a smaller battery, then that's less weight, less materials, less cost, and that's probably how Ford is hitting that $40,000 starting price for the Lightning Pro, with that standard range battery. And they, you know, they claim that they're not going to be losing money on that. They say that it's going to be, you know, at least break even to slightly profitable. So that's, you know, I think that's a good thing.
Are you excited about the Lightning? Are you super excited about this truck?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that this one is going to have, you know, because the F-150 is such a huge selling vehicle that, you know, and because Ford is also putting a lot of emphasis on the commercial users for this one, in addition to consumers. You know, I think that this vehicle is actually going to have a real impact in the marketplace, you know, in a more mainstream segment of the marketplace, not just early adopters, you know, who are, you know, the type of people who are, you know, largely going for new brands like Tesla, Rivian, Lucid, and others. But, you know, for the more traditional mainstream market, you know, to have something like this in there that those customers, you know, we'll look at and say, okay, this truck does what I need a truck to do. And, you know, it's comparable in price to the gas version. It's going to cost me less to operate it. You know, yeah, I'm going to go for it. You know, they cut off reservations a couple of weeks ago, you know, when they hit about 200,000. And that 200,000 reservations number does not include the reservation that they've got a separate reservation system that they had for their commercial customers. So that's just retail customers.
Oh, wow.
And they haven't said how many reservations they've gotten from the commercial customers, but from the conversations I've had, it sounds like there's been a lot of interest from fleet users for this thing.
I found it interesting the number of people that, like, either friends, acquaintances, random Joes who conversations have happened with, that when this truck comes up, both people looking at it as commercial and as personal use that aren't the kind of people you would think, like you said, they aren't those early adopters. They aren't the, oh, I got to have an EV. I got to have an EV. It's the latest tech. They're more like, no, I got to have a truck that does what I need my truck to do. That are really genuinely excited and quite curious about this. Like, what do you know about it? Have you driven it? Have you done this? Have you done that? There's some real curiosity from a segment of people that I guess would say, I don't think they were curious about the Rivian. Do you know what I mean? Just mm-hmm. because that was too like, oh, new company, whatever. I don't want some frou-frou truck. But suddenly it's an F-150, so it's taken more seriously. It's like, wait, they did this to an F-150? Well, maybe this is actually something to pay attention to. And I think that's a good thing for EVs. And I think it's going to, like you said, it could really move things forward for the segment and for getting people into EVs and the commercial use. The potential there is just huge. Huge.
Yeah, and Rivian, you know, to their credit, has not really targeted the same
right.
buyers as yes. you know, an F-150 or Silverado or Ram.
Right.
You know, it's a smaller truck. You know, it's
right.
it's a lifestyle truck. They admit that.
Yeah.
And so their customer base is very different.
It's very different. But it's still but it just draws like, you know, there's you hear people interested, like, you know, when you're traveling and chatting with people at airports and things like that, and when, you know, they see what you're doing or what you're writing up and you talk about cars, there's certain vehicles that you know, that people have heard of or haven't heard of, and Rivian is one of those. Maybe you heard of it, maybe you haven't, you mm-hmm. know. But like everybody's heard of Ford. Everybody knows what an F-150 is, and it really has piqued people's curiosity in a unique way. To, you know, is it really a truck that can do this? Is it still going to be a truck? Is it still going to feel like my trucky truck, or is it suddenly this little EV cutesiness? It's like, no, it's a truck. Like, and I just like seeing that people are genuinely curious in a new way, as opposed to just like the fanciness of saying, oh, I've got EV tech, but EV tech in my truck, and they really, you know, two great tastes that taste great together. Does that really come together? And I'm like, I think it's going to.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, we've, in about a week and a half from now, GM is, you know, Chevrolet is going to take the wraps off the Silverado EV, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, going to be competing with this thing. It's, you know, it's the most, you know, one of the most direct competitors to the F-150 in the gas truck market. And, you know, we can't talk about the Silverado yet. That's coming up January 5th. But it's going to be a very interesting marketplace to see what happens with electric trucks over the next few years.
I'm curious, too, and not with anything that's out there that we may have heard, but, you know, in general, the F-150 that's out there right now and the Silverado that's out there right now, the F-150 interior looks so much nicer. I feel like that Ford folks did a better job, and I'm curious, you know, like, you got to step up. I feel like Chevy has to step it up to bring the Silverado to the same level there. So I'm yeah, because it hasn't, their interior wasn't.
Well, the 22 Silverado, you know, got an upgraded interior. And
it did.
And it definitely looks better.
It looks better.
And, you know, like I said, we can't talk about the Silverado EV yet.
Right.
But there's lots of stuff to say about that.
Yes.
And we'll
there will be
that.
Stuff on episode yet to be determined. Probably, there will be thoughts.
228 or 229, depending
yes,
on the timing.
It's that close.
Yeah. All right. solar roofs on cars. There's a company out of Europe called Lightyear that is getting ready to launch a car, something called the Lightyear One, an electric sedan that has solar panels on the roof and on the hood. Excuse me. And they claim you can get about 7 miles an hour of charging from the solar panels, which, you know, I think maybe in ideal conditions that might just be possible.
Yeah, I'd like to see you pull that off right now in New England, where there's
yeah.
3 minutes of sun and endless hours of snow.
Have you ever driven the Sonata hybrid with the solar roof?
I feel like I did at one point, maybe. Maybe kind of, sort of.
Yeah. you know, I've definitely had that one, and I had it in the middle of the summer.
And?
It generated some juice for the battery. Not a whole lot. Yeah, you know, after sitting out in the direct sunlight for
yeah.
you know, most of the day. You know, the hybrid battery was pretty much full, which is about far enough to go maybe about a mile and a half in EV mode. The idea of putting solar panels on a car to, you know, to collect energy from the sun while it's sitting there not being used is in theory a great idea. I love it. I have no problem with it conceptually. The reality is, though, that, you know, when you look at a house with solar panels, or you look at a solar farm, anywhere where you see solar panels installed, there's a good reason why you never see them installed in a horizontal position. They are always tilted in the general direction of where the sun is going to be through most of the day.
Because
solar panels generally, you know, they have a fairly narrow angle, of the sun's rays hitting it. You know, once you get beyond a certain angle, instead of the sun's rays generating power, they basically just reflect off.
Right.
And then they're useless. They're just glass panels that you're carrying around.
Yes.
That are adding weight and complexity.
I know. That's what you wonder. Like, you get 7 miles, where they say 7 miles an hour of electric driving, or 7 miles of electricity per hour. So, okay, cool. But how much are you losing on the times when it's not generating anything because it's a horrible cloudy day and you're carrying around this really heavy roof and hood? It's the hood of the car, too. So having driven behind a snowplow that was sanding with small boulders coming out of the sander thing, how hard is it, or how easy is it to just completely destroy the hood? I mean, you can't
how your windshield looks after, you know, 6 or 7 years of use.
Right.
And then you're driving into the sun, you see all these little pits, after being sandblasted for several years.
Right. What's that going to do to your hood, which even takes more of the brunt of that than your windshield, because it's low and it's right at the ground, and every last little pebble that falls off of a construction truck or a sanding vehicle or whatever is pinging off your hood. I'm scanning down the store, I'm like, I'm not seeing anything about the hardiness of these or what they've done to keep them from getting, I guess the roof a little bit more, I can see that surviving better, but that hood, I keep looking at that hood, I'm like, no, that hood is doomed. That is doomed. It goes right down all the way to the front. No. Well, that's breaking.
You know, when you look at this car in profile, it's a fairly attractive car, but it's very aerodynamic. You know, it slopes down at the front, slopes down at the back, you know, so the air flows over it nice and easily. But the problem there is, again, is you look at it, and it's not like you even have, you know, a lot of horizontal panels, solar panels. Mm-mm. You know, they're all at different angles. So most at any given moment of the day, depending on the position of the car relative to the sun, half of those panels are going to be pointed away from the sun.
It's going to be like one little piece. Like, at any given moment, you have 20% of your panels are actually going to be, I'm making up a number, but like, we're actually going to be able to get sun and generate anything. Also, it has those covers. I don't know if any other vehicles ever, remember the Honda, was it the Insight that had the little half moon cover things? I don't know if anything, I associate them with the Insight. I don't know if anyone else has done them, but those are also like doomsday devices in the winter, because when you go through snowbanks and stuff, you destroy those.
Yeah.
They just like rip off and look horrific.
This would be, a car like this would be a great car to drive in warm, sunny climates.
California. You know, Los Angeles.
Much closer to the equator.
California, we have a new car for you. It is the Lightyear One, but only if you're in Southern California, no place where there's ever snow.
At the LA Auto Show, we saw the Fisker Ocean, which is a nice, mid-size two-row SUV that's also going to have a full solar roof option on there. That one at least is more horizontal, so... if you're driving that thing around in California, you'll probably collect more light from that one more power from that than you might from.
And it's also not, it's not the hood. Like, the roof freaks me out enough, but the hood is just making me cringe. And I now have scanned further down the story. The price in this particular article says it's expected to be, $175,000.
Yep.
Oh, sure. Let's buy two. Yeah. See, that's so those people are. So if you're spending $175,000 on a fancy limited run, because this first run is only going to be 946 first edition models. At $175,000, you don't care if you have to take that in and have it fixed because you have the money to spare to fix your broken solar panels on your hood?
I guess. I was talking with somebody the other day. I did an interview for Marketplace Tech on solar roofs. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this. And one of the areas where I think this actually probably makes a lot more sense than on cars and SUVs is on trucks, on long haul trucks.
Yes.
You know, because you've got this large flat area, you know, on the top of the trailer. You can cover that in solar panels, and especially for things like refrigerated trucks.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and have some batteries on there. And instead of having, you know, a diesel auxiliary power unit, which is what they typically use on those things to drive the refrigeration system on a refrigerated trailer, you just cover that thing in solar panels and use an electric refrigeration unit and a battery. That would actually make a lot more sense. That would have a lot more impact on overall energy use and emissions, I think, than.
And I can see that application. That makes sense. Like, I think I'm not anti solar roof. I just, the applications, your brain is like, is this the right way to do it? But yeah, I can see that would be a great idea to put it on a commercial vehicle on a truck to act as like the refrigeration unit instead of having to do diesel that. And it's also, that's a huge surface area. So you'd have, I mean, that's vast as opposed to the tininess of the roof. Even if you do the roof and the hood and like the truck, like all the way, all the top surfaces of your vehicle, not even remotely close to how much surface you'll have on the top of a truck. That would be cool. That'd be a good idea.
All right. GM wants to sell EV parts, you know, which is, I think, kind of funny. When I wrote this up the other day, back before the late 1990s, GM used to make most of its parts in-house. Almost everything, you know, except for like tires, basically, and glass.
Really?
You know, most of the stuff that went into GM vehicles was made by their various parts divisions, which were all under various Delco brands like Delco Remy, Delco Moraine, Delco Electronics. You know, they had all these parts divisions that in the late 1990s, they bundled these all together under the Delphi brand, which they then spun off somewhere around 2000 or 2001, I think, as a separate company. They basically divested all of their parts making capabilities into a separate company. And that company went through a long, like 5-year bankruptcy reorganization a few years later. Eventually, you know, it now the remains of that, you know, a lot of the various businesses either got shut down or sold off mm-hmm. to other companies. What's left of it now exists as Aptiv, which is focused on electrical and electronic architectures and driver assist systems. And everything else is gone. But now, as GM and other automakers, legacy automakers, are getting into EVs, they're going back to making a lot of parts in-house, making motors and batteries and stuff in-house. And one of the things GM wants to do is they want to be able to sell these parts to anybody that wants to use them. And so they're really pushing, you know, they've done a couple of deals this year with their fuel cell technology for long-haul trucks with Navistar. They're working with a European company on aviation using fuel cells and also on locomotives. And they want to offer their batteries and motors and electronics to basically anybody that wants to buy them. And so, you know, they're looking at things like, one of the first things they're doing is selling the conversion kits for older cars, you know, for resto mods using their electric motors and batteries.
I think that's awesome. I want to see like they have here an El Camino with like an EV to convert it into being an EV. That would be awesome.
They showed this one at SEMA. It's one of their most recent ones. It was actually built by Lingenfelter, who does a lot of aftermarket stuff.
For GM. Want those to be EVs because you pull up to those, like anything like that, these vintage cars on the, you know, when they're next to you at a stoplight or whatever, and the good gravy, the smell of the exhaust, and then you're like, oh, I could just feel the world dying around it and just have it be quiet little happy little EV. That would be kind of cool.
Did you watch the HBO series Watchmen?
Yes.
One of the interesting details in there, you know, I don't know if you ever read the graphic novel or saw the original movie, but you know, one of the things that happened in the original story was Dr. Manhattan had come up with some, I forget what the details were, but came up with some source of electricity that was basically limitless and, you know, no emissions and everything. And right. So in the HBO series, all the cars they drive around in are, you know, modern or even, you know, vintage. Like the main character, whose name escapes me, the cop, she was driving around in a black Buick Grand National. But when you see it, you realize, wait a minute, that thing doesn't sound like a Grand National. It's electric. All the cars in there were electric. And so it would be, you know, cool to actually be able to make that happen. You know, so you've got cars like this El Camino from Lingenfelter, you know, and GM also, you know, they're working with Textron. One of Textron's divisions makes ground support equipment for airports. You know, like the belt loaders that they use to put the baggage in the cargo holds of the airplanes, and the tugs they use to move the aircraft around. They want to electrify those using GM electric motors. So I think it's cool that they want to do this.
I think it is cool. I'm looking at this picture. I was thinking it was stairs, like the stairs that drive up to an airplane, but I guess it actually
you
is
could
like
do that
a baggage
too.
Loader. But all I can think of with this image sitting there is Arrested Development with all the money's in the banana stand. Like I see that and I'm like, oh, it's Arrested Development. No, it's not. This is actually nothing. But that's what that will forever remind me of when I see a picture of those by themselves.
Excellent. Let's see. And one last one. Volkswagen, last year started launching their ID lineup of electric vehicles. They launched the ID3 in Europe, the ID4, which we have here now. They're bringing out the ID5, the ID Buzz, and there's more coming. And apparently, they in Europe have started rolling out an update to those vehicles, an over-the-air software update, which is increasing the maximum charging rate for these. So right now, they're limited to 125 kilowatts, maximum charge rate, and they're bumping that up to 135 for standard models and 150 for the ID5 GTX model, which is the sportier version of the ID5, which is a coupe version of the ID4, which we don't get here. You know, presumably they will continue to do this. And I think this is one of the interesting capabilities that we have now with these modern vehicles with over-the-air updates, to be able to improve some of these capabilities, like the charging speed, maximum charging speeds. You know, Ford already on the Mach-E has pushed out an over-the-air update for the Mach-E that changes the charging profile. So, you know, one of the complaints with the Mach-E was if you're doing fast charging, when the battery got to 80% charge, the charge rate would drop from 80 kilowatts down to 10, which is basically the same you get at home.
Right.
And they changed that, so it now goes to 90% before it steps down. So, you know, if you're doing a road trip, it's much more convenient. You can get much more charge into the car before it starts to slow down.
Yeah, this is, looking at this, it says it'll cut charging times by up to 9 minutes when charging from 5 to 80%. That's pretty significant, like 9 minutes. Like you said, especially if you are doing a road trip, if you're chopping 10 minutes off every time almost you charge your car, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty cool. It is sort of, I know EVs, you know, 10 years ago were very of the future, 15 years ago or whatever. But just the idea that they can, over the air, make your car cooler than it was when you parked it in your driveway last night is just really kind of neat. It's neat that they can make these improvements that are, it doesn't cost you anything as a consumer. You're not paying like, I need an extra, here's $2,000, give me the new and improved. Nope, we're just going to boost this out to you. Boom, your battery's better than it was. Your charging is better than it was yesterday. Like, hey, thanks. And that's cool.
That's one of the things we can thank Tesla for. I mean, that's one of the things that Tesla did really well was over-the-air updates, you know, and enabling using an electronic architecture that can do that. And now, you know, other manufacturers are using that. Of course, not all of them are using it in ways that we would actually like. Like, for example, Toyota. I can't remember. Did we talk about Toyota's OTA update for remote charging last week?
No, I don't remember.
I don't think we touched on this story. So this actually came out last week, where the Toyota vehicles from 2018 onward have the ability to, and actually, you know, a lot of Toyota vehicles have built-in remote start capability using the key fob. But you can also, and this is also true of a lot of manufacturers, you know, if the vehicle's got connectivity, you can also remote start it using an app from your phone.
Right.
So, you know, cold days, you don't have to go outside and fire it up. You can just do it from your kitchen table while you're eating your breakfast and warm up the car. They are changing that so that now, when you bought the vehicles, it came with 3 years of complimentary connected vehicle services. And so you got that charging capability for free, you know, as part of when you bought the vehicle.
Okay.
Now, as that 3 year time period is coming up, they're saying, okay, now you have to pay $8 a month if you want to continue to use the remote charging or the remote start capability. Except that it's not just for the using it from the app with connectivity. It's also for the key fob, which is not actually using the network
so
at all.
Key functions the way that it's
lock and unlock with your key fob, but if you want to turn on remote start from your key fob, you have to pay $8 a month.
Okay, no, that's not cool. I get the doing it with the app. I get because there's all sorts of things that you subscribe to for your app to have extra access and this and that and the other thing on there and all sorts of different functionality that you can subscribe to that all of the OEMs have things that you can
There are legitimate costs associated with that, you know, for the data costs and you know, bandwidth and everything else.
And I get that, but like for your key fob is your key fob.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a stinker. I don't like that. That would make me cranky. I'd be like, wait, okay, fine. I'll lose being able to do it on my phone, but I can't even use my key fob to do it anymore.
And this is one of the things everybody wants over the air updates for their cars. Well, get used to having to pay for subscriptions for all these kinds of features.
And I know, I know that they're going to do that. Like, even as I was saying, it's great that they'll update things. And I know there will always be some things that they will probably just update and say, it doesn't matter. We're just updating it. Here you go. It's free.
Yeah.
And that there's going to be things where it's like, hey, we have this capability, but if you want it, it's going to be X number of dollars. But that seems like more than that. That's not just, I think what makes that feel like bad form, it's not just, hey, we have a new thing that we can do. If you want the new thing, it will cost you this much extra. I'm kind of okay with that. I'm not okay with, hey, we have this thing that your key in your hand does. We've changed our mind. It won't do that unless you pay us $8 a month. That's not the same. That's taking stuff away from me that I don't like that one. Yeah, that's tough. That's a tough pill to swallow.
But we're going to see a lot more of that going forward, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're probably right.
All right, let's answer some questions from the readers.
All right, readers.
Let's start with Coach Cabrera. He says, as federal and state subsidies for EVs expire, what is preventing them from becoming a niche market instead of mainstream? Most people will be turned away by these $40,000 pricing levels.
Oh, what's the question? So is it...
we've already seen Tesla and GM hit the cap on EV tax breaks, the 200,000 sales cap. And so now if you buy an EV from Tesla or GM, you no longer get federal tax credits on those.
Okay.
And other manufacturers are going to hit that threshold in the next couple of years. And because, it doesn't look like the Build Back Better Act is going to pass with expanded tax incentives for EVs. As those tax incentives go away, what's going to prevent them from just becoming a niche product instead of going mainstream?
In a way, I mean, they're kind of niche now because even with the incentives and things, EVs can still be pricey, depending, even affordable EVs. And you're still looking at like you know, and it depends on the state, I guess. There's not a lot of incentives in New England, but I don't think there's anything where I am in New Hampshire, really. But you still have to, you know, pony up the cost to get a charger, a level two charger installed at your house, which is something that, you know, is an extra chunk of change, you know, to have an electrician come out and run wires and do whatever. So I think there's always been a certain, like, cutting out people whose incomes are tighter just by the nature of EVs right now. And because it's not like you know, you don't have EV chargers everywhere. You don't have one in your house. So there's extra cost associated with that will not ever be associated with owning a gas vehicle right now. I don't know. I think it might slow it down a little, but I feel like people who are going for EVs at this point, it's like, okay, maybe I'll pick EVA that still has a, you know, an incentive as opposed to EVB, which doesn't. It might change which one you get a little bit, but I feel like people who are going in for EVs are going to go in for EVs. And I feel like there's more and more people that are ready to accept that. And the fact that they may or may not get an incentive is not going to stop them. I think that, and it is, as there's more out there, you know, how many EVs are there are coming? How many EVs have just been introduced? The cost, the pricing on those is going to come down, you know, it's no longer just, okay, you have all these crossovers, like everyone's introducing these crossovery kind of things because crossovers are a big deal. Well, you start to get that same kind of stuff going into more, you know, a cheap sedan, which, you know, the Nissan Versa equivalent of an EV or like a Leaf or something, you can still get into these things pretty cheap if you want to. Your selection is much smaller. I don't know that it's going to make them a niche market. I don't know that it's going to keep them from, I don't know that it's going to change them becoming mainstream any faster or slower. I don't know. What do you think, Sam? You think it's going to slow it down?
No, I don't, because, you know, battery prices are coming down. As we said, you know, batteries are the biggest cost driver in an EV. The prices have been coming down steadily for the past decade and will continue to drop in the coming years as volumes go up. And the price of the EVs is coming down. You know, yeah, most of them today are still, you know, $40,000 now, but there are cheaper ones.
Yeah.
You can get that Kona EV starting at $34,000.
Right.
And that's before incentives, you know, so, you know, with $7,500, you're down, you know, in that $27,000, $28,000 price range. GM has said there's going to be a $30,000 Equinox sized crossover coming in the next couple of years. There's going to be a lot of these vehicles, a lot of EVs, you know, that are going to get down to that $30,000 and sub $30,000 price point over the next couple of years. Up until now, most of what we've seen, yes, has been more premium, more expensive. But a lot of what's coming out is actually going to be priced pretty comparably to the equivalent gasoline vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the F-150 Lightning is an example.
Yep.
You know, you compare comparably equipped against a gas F-150, and they're in some cases cheaper. You know, the base Lightning Pro is, you know, a couple of grand cheaper than a four-wheel drive crew cab F-150 XL.
Mm-hmm.
So we will see more affordable EVs coming. And I think that will, you know, even with the incentives potentially going away, you know, we'll still see adoption of those vehicles in increasing numbers. And especially when you consider that, you know, the cost of operating those vehicles, you know, the cost for electricity is a lot less than the cost for gasoline.
Then
people will eventually come to that realization, and we will, I think we will see them continue to grow.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's going to change things that much. So.
All right. Gupta AJ on Twitter asked, do GM and Ford still have lots of unfinished trucks sitting in storage and waiting for parts? Are they currently like Toyota that's shipping Tundras as soon as they come off the assembly line? There are still some. The numbers of unfinished trucks are shrinking because they are, in some cases, they're shipping them minus certain features and you know, telling customers that as soon as they have the parts available, you know, they can bring them in and they will retrofit them. So, you know, things like, you know, some of the heated seats or features like Super Cruise and some other options that they're leaving out the ECUs for those. And then, you know, once the parts are available, you'll be able to bring them into the dealer and they will they'll put those parts in and you'll get that functionality back. They're trying to ship as many as they can. There's still some out there, but not as much as there was back in June and July.
They're making every effort, I think, to come up with solutions. Okay, if we can't ship it right this second as we want it, how can we at least ship it? You know,
yeah.
So they're working with it. You know, it's going to be a little while before things are normal, but they're it's getting better.
Yeah, slowly. Brianna Wu asked, drive and enjoy a sports car in the snow or treat her like a garage queen and lock her up
in the snow.
Absolutely. Drive it
in the snow.
You know, depending on how much snow, you know, and how much ground clearance you have, obviously that's a factor.
Yes.
But you know, yeah, put winter tires on it, drive it in the snow.
Put winter tires on it. I'm a big fan of BlizzX. I love those things. Put those on your car, get out there and drive. Your only obstacle is if you have a very, you know, sports car, generally low. So if you have that snowbank that's a foot high, well, in your SUV, not a problem. In your sports car, you've just buried your nose in the snow. So you have to be a little bit more cautious of that. If it's actively crazy snowing and there's big berms of snow as you cross from one street to the next, otherwise take it out there and drive it. I think the only time I wouldn't is if I had some like crazy, highly collectible, you know, limited edition 1952, whatever. Like collectible cars, no, because that means you guarantee some guy's gonna, you know, scrape the bejesus out of your car as he comes barreling through an intersection. But otherwise, take your sports car, enjoy it.
Yeah.
It goes right along with the idea that like people that buy china and crystal and only use it at Christmas and Thanksgiving. No, enjoy your stuff. Use your stuff all the time. Why have it and just leave it locked up? Enjoy all the stuff all the time.
Yeah, I mean, do a little research and find out how susceptible your car is to corrosion.
Yes.
Some older cars are more susceptible to corrosion.
Right.
Like first generation Miatas, did have a tendency to rust if exposed to salt, and so I don't drive my Miata in the wintertime.
Fair.
In the past, when I had a Mustang, a couple of different Mustangs, I drove those things all year round. I put winter tires on them. We put winter tires on my daughter's Toyota 86 a month ago. Put a set of BlizzX on there. They're fine.
I'm trying to get winter tires onto my Charger, my rear-wheel drive Charger, and we had an appointment. Here's the sort of labor shortage of the day. Literally, the poor guys at Pep Boys called me this morning and said, we can't put them on. I'm like, oh, what happened? He's like, not one of my guys would come in today. He didn't have a single guy who was willing to come into work. He's like, I have to call 17 customers today and tell them all we can't do the service they had scheduled because we have. So, you know, theoretically, tomorrow they will be on the car when I've tried yet again to get an appointment.
As long as the ground clearance of your car is adequate for the amount of snow you have and you put some proper tires on it, there's no reason to keep it locked up in the wintertime.
Go have fun, it's meant to be driven.
My first job out of college was working for Delco Moraine on ABS systems, and the first vehicle I was assigned to work on was the Lotus M100 Elan.
No way.
And we also had an Esprit that was already in production with the ABS system that we had in our fleet as a demo car. And I spent lots of time driving those suckers in the snow and ice.
Nice.
That was one of the fun things about working on ABS and traction control in those days.
You have to go take these out on the worst roads you can find.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. In the wintertime, we had north test. In the summertime, we had south to hot places to find the most extreme conditions.
That would be fun. Yeah, that would be really
so,
fun.
So, I mean, I've driven a Lamborghini Diablo on a frozen lake in northern Sweden.
Nice.
On a snow and ice pad. I've driven the Elan and Esprit around the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in February. So,
very cool.
As long as you got the right tires,
right,
it's a blast. It's a hoot.
And tires.
It's again one of those things where, like driving a slow car fast is better than a fast car slow. The limits, for a sports car are going, even with good tires, are going to be significantly lower.
Yeah.
Than on dry pavement. You can get the back end coming around. Yeah, be careful. Be responsible.
Be responsible, grown up, but have a little fun.
Yeah, don't. I mean, the Isaac Newton's first law of motion, you know, still applies. You know, it has not yet been superseded. You know, F still equals ma, still equals mu n. So, you know, if you have less mu, you're going to have less force.
That was the most engineering thing you've said in ages. That was brilliant.
But you can have a blast, and you know, make sure you take along throw a tow strap in the trunk, so that if you do get stuck, you know, you can get some help. Yeah. You know, maybe put in a couple of those, I forget what they're called, you know, like traction pads.
Like Max Trax or something.
Yeah.
You need Max Trax in the back of your Miata.
that you can stick under the drive wheels there and, you know, use it to help you get out when you get stuck in some deep snow.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, yeah, go have fun.
Have at it, Brianna.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. From Wes, he's got a couple of questions. Based on the popularity and usefulness of front and rear dash cams, do you foresee them as being standard or optional equipment from the OEMs in the near future? Maybe include insurance discounts. What do you think? Standard dash cams?
I can't see them doing... I can't see that. I can see it being aftermarket. I don't think standard... Because most people, you're right. They do help you, and they can sometimes. You have that as an insurance issue. Then you can prove that the guy cut you off, and you know. But I don't feel like that would be a standard equipment thing. I don't know. What do you think, Sam?
I don't think so either, because it's something that is helpful after a crash for diagnosing what happened, but it's not really a safety feature that's going to prevent crashes.
Right.
And as such, I don't see that as something that's going to be mandated. I mean, some manufacturers are building in that functionality. Tesla, for example, you can use the forward facing cameras as a dash cam, mm-hmm. that are part of autopilot. Maybe we will see that. Maybe we will see, manufacturers include a bit of storage. Today, all vehicles have an event data recorder. So when there's a crash that triggers the airbags, it saves about 5 seconds of data, things like your vehicle speed, acceleration, direction, things like that. And that's stored on the vehicle. It's just a running buffer. Whenever your airbags go off, mm-hmm. it stores that, writes that to the memory and saves that for diagnosis later on. Maybe we'll see something like that, because most new cars do have at least a forward-facing camera for lane keeping assist and collision, automatic emergency braking. So there's no reason you couldn't store that data. You just have to add some memory and some software to do that. Rear-facing, less likely, and I don't see it as something that's likely to be regulated.
Yeah, I don't think so either, because like you said, it gives you info after the fact. It doesn't actually keep you safer to begin with, so that's not the kind of stuff they generally regulate. So,
yeah. And then his other question, as EVs grow in popularity, cities will start to lose taxes from gas sales. Well, not just cities, but also states.
Everybody, yeah. Yeah,
and the federal government, too. This will likely lead to higher taxes on electricity. So from a financial aspect, will electric cars become more expensive to use than gasoline vehicles when it comes to energy usage?
Not so much taxes on electricity, but and I think these are already in place in certain areas where there's an extra tax on EVs to cover what they've lost in the gas tax, like the taxes that you pay there. And aren't there some proposals where it's like it's going to look at the miles that you've driven? So when you go to re-register your car, if you drove 5,000 miles this year, you will pay an X additional fee as an EV that didn't pay any tax on your gas. Whereas if you drove 20,000, your tax is going to be that much more because you drove 20,000 miles. And so not changing the price of electricity, so you're not paying more just to do the electricity in your house, but changing how they get those taxes out of an EV, I see happening.
Yeah, you said, some locations do have, some states do have, a surcharge when you register your vehicle. If it's an EV, you have to pay an extra $100, $150 a year,
right,
on top of your license plate tags, which offsets the lost revenue from gas taxes. There have been a bunch of proposals for some sort of VMT tax, a vehicle miles mm-hmm. travel tax, which, that would be roughly equivalent to a gas tax. The more miles you drive with a gasoline vehicle, the more gas you're going to use, the more tax you're going to pay. And so, just having a VMT tax like that Because obviously also the more miles you drive, the more wear and tear you're putting on the road infrastructure.
Right.
So I think that that's something like that is a perfectly fair and reasonable thing to do. Especially, as EVs become mainstream, those are using the roads should contribute to the upkeep and maintenance of those roads.
Agree. I don't think it'll get more expensive though. His usage, will they become more expensive? I think they might. There might be less of a savings than there was if they start instituting all these taxes to make up for the gas tax that you're losing and the extra fees, But I don't think it would take a lot to make the cost of driving that EV more expensive than driving the gas equivalent.
Because electricity is still a lot cheaper than even the base price of the fuel before the taxes on it, before the road taxes. So just, the base price of gasoline is still a lot more than the equivalent amount of electricity you're going to use to drive the same distance.
And when you think about the other cost savings of having an EV where you're not doing, oil changes and all that kind of, the other things, the maintenance things you don't have to do for an EV that you still have to do for, put those into to the cost on the gas side. You never have to pay that for an EV. So it's not, it's not something that's going to get more expensive. There's maintenance savings to having an EV that you just that also add into not just the cost of the fuel, whether it's gas or electric.
Yeah, your overall cost of ownership is still going to have a significant advantage for an EV versus a gasoline equivalent vehicle.
Right.
Especially if you're driving bigger, heavier vehicles.
Yep.
All right. Two more. Michael Burns asks, and this is actually more of a follow-up from last time, regarding the question about why headlights and windshield wipers aren't integrated from the previous episode. They do integrate. They do on some vehicles.
Some vehicles,
His Michael's 2018 Ram 1500 has this option in the infotainment configuration for the car, and my 2016 Chrysler Town Country, without the older single-color configuration menu in the dashboard, also has this feature. I keep it turned on all the time. It's the law in Georgia. So what he's talking about is, whenever the windshield wipers come on, you also want to turn on the headlights for extra visibility. And even though the headlights may not necessarily help you see much better, it helps others see you.
Right.
And that's the same purpose behind daytime running lamps, is to allow others to see you better. So what the writer to your show should have asked is why cars are not equipped with automatic courtesy sensors that respond to another driver like me flashing my lights at you for not having... for not driving with your lights on in pouring rain. there. Go make bank on that feature, Bosch or whoever. That would be a little more complicated to implement. To do that reliably. I think just having the lights come on automatically with the wipers, that's pretty easy to do and pretty effective. Having something that turns on your lights when somebody flashes their lights at you,
a police car driving their headlights flash, flashing lights and stuff. So now,
and there can be other flashing lights around you.
Right, That would be really.
That'd be really
tough.
It would be very hard to do that reliably.
If Bosch has engineers that smart, have at it, Bosch. But I feel like that's that's going to be a tough one to overcome that way. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, last one. This is from Drew in Jacksonville. It says, the government and some industry players are pushing all EVs, a bit short-sighted since they are essentially all coal or natural gas powered right now. I do think that we should be better at using renewable resources, but there is one issue that really gets ignored in most things that I read and hear, namely, if my future options are only an e-vehicle, how will I charge it? I don't just mean infrastructure and refueling or the current issue with limited range. What I mean is that I live in a house built in the 1990s, and the breaker panel is full and the garage is full. We have two cars that cannot be stored in the garage, even if we could use one of the open 15 or 20 amp outlets. When I've talked to Tesla fans, they tout the Sentry mode, which is the ability, the autopilot cameras, to use them as security cameras. I live in Florida. Is the solution to run an extension cord out of the garage to the car in the frequent rain and rely on Sentry mode? I live in the suburbs, but they are not without our porch pirates and vandals. Seems very myopic. I have a Ford Expedition, and I think that the F-150 Lightning looks great, but I struggle with the range and the home charging.
Well, you can. I mean, you can. The charging cord, like plug that's attached to the level 2 charger, you can just plug that in outside, and it can be dumping rain, and your car is still fine.
Yeah, I mean, most of the wall charger units that you can get, the 240-volt chargers, are weatherproofed. So you can install them on the side of your house and the side of your garage. And, if your garage is full and you can't park your cars in the garage, I mean, that's a completely different. Separate issue.
Right.
That has nothing to do with EVs.
Right.
I know people who have that situation. I have two cars parked in my two-car garage. That's a separate issue. But, yeah, you can certainly mount, the wall box on the outside of the house. Or even just have a 240 volt outlet outside, in a box on the side of the house or the side of the garage, so you can park it outside.
When he's talking about like vandals, like porch pirates, and he's like, okay, so that they would come in.
What are they going to do? Like pull into your driveway and use your plug to charge their EV?
Or just be like malicious and unplug your car for kicks and giggles? Because they could also just be malicious and do something nasty to your gas vehicle. I don't think that changes the nature of the guy who's a jerk who wants to mess with your car. I'm not quite sure I follow that. But you can, you don't need to. An extension cord is not what you're supposed to do. I think every single thing will say, don't just, plug your car in an extension cord. That's not what they recommend, I don't think, for a single EV. Same.
Yeah, it's not really safe. It's also less efficient. You're going
to. Right. And it's not rated to do that. So they would tell you not to do that. None of them want you to do that. But you can, put a level 2 charger either in your garage or just outside your garage and plug it in and, plug your car in and. I guess technically someone could steal your EV charger or put it in the garage and run it outside, run the little plug outside the garage and plug in your EV.
Yeah.
That would work too.
Yeah. You can, there's a lot of ways to deal with that.
Yeah.
As far as, if your breaker panel is full, that can be upgraded. There's obviously a cost associated with that. That can be fairly costly. I mean, if you're talking about replacing your panel, if you don't have any available slots in your breaker panel, then, that can be a few $1,000s. I think in most cases, depending on how much capacity you have coming into the house and how much you're using, you may be able to add just an auxiliary panel. So you don't necessarily have to replace your entire existing panel.
Yeah.
You can add a second auxiliary panel just with breakers for your charging outlet. So that's, there are solutions for that. There are ways.
I mean, it would require, you have a house that was built in the 90s. I have a house that was built in the 70s. We had our panel replaced years ago just for other reasons. But, it's one of the things you as the 90s get further back there, you do have to do upgrades, and especially older houses just in general because of the number of electronic things we have in our home. Forget cars. You've got, computers, and you've got, your Wi-Fi, and you've got everything, you've got three TVs instead of one, and you're charging your phones and you're charging your laptop. There's a lot, upgrades are required for the usage of electric in older homes. And I think probably going forward, one of those upgrades, if people were upgrading a panel, as EVs become more and more the norm, I can see it being much more likely that an electrician would say, okay, so when you get an EV or for an EV, you need to do this. Do you want to do that now? I feel like, because they make suggestions.
And the thing is, that's going
to
be a one-time purchase as well.
Once.
Once you've done that, when you replace your EV with another EV, you don't have to do that again.
Right. It's done. It works. You're all set. You don't have to do it again. Yeah.
And then the last thing I wanted to address was the source of electricity. Just to be on the safe side, I did actually look up on the Energy Information Agency website, which is part of the Department of Energy. The utility scale electricity generation in the U.S. in 2020, out of four 4,000 gigawatt hours a year, I think. That's what I'm asking. Anyway, out of the total utility scale electricity that was generated in 2020 in the U.S., roughly 40%, a little shy of 41% of that came from natural gas. 19% came from coal. Coal has coal generation has been declining steadily for a long time and will continue to decline. We actually had more energy in 2020 generated from nuclear. It was 19.7% versus 19.3% from coal. And 19.8% came from renewables.
So it is moving already. It's already moving in the right direction. And it's, as things get upgraded, infrastructure upgrades are huge. So as old things sort of need to be replaced, then the new things that often come in are more renewable, more, efficient, aren't relying on things, like you said, Sam, like coal is just disappearing as those coal plants are being replaced with other better options for the environment. So,
And keep in mind, this is just for utility scale generation. This does not include distributed energy resources. So people that have solar panels on their house, businesses that have solar panels, on their factories or warehouses or wherever, all that distributed energy resources is not included in this. So if you add in all of that solar and
wind, the numbers are better even.
Then you're up closer to somewhere around, I think, 25 or 26% already coming from renewables.
Wow.
And it's been growing steadily for more than a decade now. So, those numbers will continue to get better as we go forward.
There you go.
All right. That's it for this week. And this, I think, will be the last show for 2021.
It will.
The next one will be a new year, 2022, and hopefully we'll have Robbie back for that one.
Yeah.
So see you next time.
Bye, guys.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.